Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our regular dive into the news. And with me is a holiday-bound Adrian Reynolds. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, Phil.
It's your last one before going away.
Satellite delay there, because I'm almost metaphorically
He's metaphorically
abroad.
In France. Yeah, okay, fine, very good. And John Stevens, our National Director, here as well.
I'm not about to go on holiday, not until August.
Indeed, neither am I. But this will perhaps be the last time you see the three of us until September, I guess. We might have some fill-ins over the summer, but this will be the last hurrah before the holidays hit. Well, good to be with you again to talk about what's been going on in the news. Before we get into that, Adrian, we've just recorded a short pod about the Leaders Conference.
We have.
Just tell us a bit about the dates and what's coming up, and where
9th
people can book.
To 11th of November or 9th to the 12th of November if you book the 3-day event rather than the 2-day event.
Yep.
The subject is prayer or communion with God, really, that prayer flows out of. Pour out your hearts. It's what it's called. Being joined by Aubrey Sequeira, Steve Casey, Andy Mason, Carolyn Lacey, Christy Mayer. Oh, a whole host of really good topics. One-off seminars on the topic. Really good preacher. I'm excited about it. And,
fantastic.
Come and join us if you can. 20th of July, Phil, for the early bird discount.
Early bird discount. So we'll put the links in the show note. It'd be great to see you at the Leaders Conference in November. And John, this afternoon, I have signed a contract to give us the new booking system for Rising Lights.
Brilliant.
You are able to reveal exclusively, John, when Rising Lights 2027 bookings will open.
We're really delighted. Bookings for Rising Lights are going to open on the 3rd of September.
Correct.
So the summer is a great opportunity to plan to come. You can book your accommodation already. So there are options there that you could book, so you don't have to book Rising Lights to get your accommodation sorted out. But it would be great over the summer to think about other people you could encourage to come, getting a church group together, encouraging students in your church to come. So 3rd of September is going to be the booking date. Our speaker next year is Jason Roach, who's from London City Mission. He's going to be giving our main Bible readings. Starts on the 29th of March, so just after Easter again. The other good news is we're going to increase our children's provision. So last year, I think we had 700 children's places. We're hoping to have around 900 this year. We think those will go quite quickly. So if you're planning on coming with kids of all ages, do get ready to book on the 3rd of September. But we would love to see you in Torquay in 2027.
And we are recording this on Tuesday. And I think today was our last local conference in Cambridge. So those
are
33 conferences that have come to an end. So we're really grateful to the Lord for sustaining us through that. And it's been a great topic. You can look back on all the videos that we showed at the local conferences there on our website. You could perhaps use them with your eldership teams, that kind of thing. And we hope it helps you as you think about that really important message of unity that we've been thinking about in our local conferences this year. Let's talk about what's been going on in the news, because we've had a really interesting week. As I say, we're recording this on Tuesday. I think it was Thursday last week. We finally received outline plans for a ban on what's called conversion therapy. This is something that the government have looked at before, and it never made it onto the statute. And on Thursday last week, we got a list of all the things in which the government is looking to ban in terms of conversion therapy practices. Of course, if you haven't heard about this is very simply those who identify as LGBT feeling that there should be a ban on any attempt to divert them in any way from that kind of lifestyle choice. And of course, churches fear they will be caught up in this. There's all sorts of ways that might happen in our churches. John, I note you have printed the entire draft bill,
and
it is there before you, and annotated it.
You might not be able to see that if you're listening.
I mean, it's interesting. It doesn't seem to be, in a quick read and what I read in news articles, it doesn't seem manifestly different to what was rejected previously. I know you think you've spotted some differences, which would be good. It's worth saying there are some fears about this from churches and Christians, rightly so, John.
Oh, well, there are lots of fears bound up with it. It's worth saying this has been coming ever since Theresa May first proposed it. So although it's the Labour government that's finally put a bill forward, actually it was Theresa May who said she was going to introduce it. What was that, 6 prime ministers ago?
That's only about 4 years.
60, I think.
It's 60. Taken so long. Just shows how difficult it is to draft this. So what government is wanting to do is to stop practices that are used to stop people being sort of LGBTQ, claims that people can be, in a sense, turned from being sort of gay. That's what they mean by conversion therapy. And the difficulty is of defining that in a way that really works. Mm. Virtually everybody accepts there are some practices that are illegitimate, that have been used in the past.
And there are some that are already illegal.
And some that are already illegal. In fact, one of the criticisms criticisms of this legislation is that many of the things that people would think are abusive are already illegal.
Things like coercive control, rape, that kind of thing.
Indeed. Yeah, yeah. Although actually the draft comments on the draft bill make clear there's some elements of conversion practice, as they call it, which are not currently clearly sort of inappropriate. So it doesn't cover absolutely everything, but lots of the worst practices of causing harm to people are already criminalized. So the difficulty is, how do you define it in a way that excludes things that people rightly think shouldn't be practiced, whilst actually allowing freedom of religion, freedom of belief? And I think, therefore, it's the definition that is extremely complex. I think, having looked at it, the legislation that's being proposed is nowhere near as restrictive as, for example, the legislation in the state of Victoria.
This is in Australia, isn't it?
Where in the state of Victoria, they basically set out in the legislation to ban conversion practice altogether. So praying with a person about their sexual orientation, helping them to resist sexual desire, would be prevented under the Victorian legislation.
Just help us there, John, because I think some of the narrative I've read is that this does ban those things.
And parents could be caught under the legislation we've been reading as well.
Well, I think that's the problem here is that I mean, we could go into this. This would be a lengthy thing to discuss, but that's a question of the definition of what's covered. And I think even some of the responses that have been made have said there'll be a fear that that could be the case, but it's unlikely that it actually would be the case. And that's because of the way it's drafted. So what the legislation does is it speaks about conversion practice. Conversion practice is any attempt to persuade an individual that they do or don't have a sexual orientation. So actually, somebody who tries to persuade somebody who believes they're heterosexual that they're gay could be actually caught by this legislation. That would be a conversion practice. So it doesn't apply simply in relation to trying to persuade people that they're not homosexually orientated. It operates the other way around. So there's a very broad definition of what's called a conversion practice. It could be almost any conversation with an individual about their sexual orientation and what sexual orientation they
have. Could it be a sermon?
Well, I think that's unlikely because it's about dealing with an individual.
Okay.
So I think it's unlikely that this legislation in its current shape would prevent preaching and teaching in a generalized sense about what the Bible teaches about sort of homosexuality and Christian beliefs about it, because it's directed to an individual, not to more general teaching. In order for it to be a criminal offence, it then needs to be an abusive kind of conversion practice.
How are we defining that?
Well, that's defined quite broadly. It's a matter of fact for the court to take into account, but it includes factors like whether or not words or behaviour of a sexual nature are used, violence or threatening words, controlling or coercive words, economic pressure or psychological or emotional pressure. Now, that then gets picked up in the draft guidance, and it is relatively extreme things that are covered there. So there's no mention in the guidance, the explanatory notes, of just praying with a person. It includes, they would say, issues like, for example, using aversion therapy, corrective sexual assault, it's physical threats, electroshock treatment.
But is that not already illegal?
It is. Words or behaviour designed to make an individual subordinate or dependent. Humiliation and intimidation that's used to harm, punish or frighten an individual. Severely limiting an individual's ability to earn, manage or use their own money. And again, manipulation or humiliation. Now, in the vast majority of cases, that's not going to be ordinary pastoral counselling and prayer that Christians would bring to somebody. It might be in a very highly intensive Christian context. You could say that the pressure to an individual to be part of the community might be regarded as being potentially...
Or the threat of church discipline.
Abusive, yes. That could be if you're being excluded from the community and the consequences there. So there is some danger there. But it's not enough that it just be an abusive conversion practice. Actually, it's only a criminal offence if it then causes harm.
Now, that's my question.
And this is how that's defined. Okay. It has to cause serious harm to an individual's physical or mental health. It's quite a high threshold, serious. Or it has to cause serious alarm or distress to the individual, But it's not enough just for it to be serious alarm or distress. It says which has a substantially adverse effect on their usual day-to-day activities. So in effect, what's being criminalised is a conversion practice that causes quite a high level of harm to the individual. Now, of course, the problem is we don't quite know what that means, what will be judged to be serious harm.
It's quite subjective, isn't
harm.
It? Isn't it?
Well, the law is used to dealing with categories like serious. All I'm saying is that is quite a high threshold that is to be imposed. So people may well think they have been treated with a conversion practice, but if it hasn't affected, for example, the way they live their day-to-day lives in any significant way, or it hasn't led to a serious impact on their physical or mental health, then it wouldn't be criminalised. So this does seem to set quite a high standard that needs to be satisfied. And I think much of the concern at the moment is over the uncertainty it's bound to generate. And people will fear that they are perhaps causing a behaviour might be a criminal offence, or individuals will claim that they have been mistreated. Mm. And so people will be investigated, and it will take a bit of time for the police, the prosecuting authorities, to kind of work out where that threshold lies. So all of that uncertainty is very unhelpful. It arguably introduces a sort of an element of kind of restriction on religious freedom as well. I mean, after all, there are those who are Christians who believe there's no such thing as a gay sexual orientation. Mm. That would be an area that simply saying that to an individual would clearly be a conversion practice, could be then something that could cause harm to individuals.
The Christian Institute have said they're going to challenge it.
I'm sure they're going to challenge it. But it seems to me that the area that's most likely to attract difficulties for evangelical Christians is prayer to resist sexual temptation in a very intense environment of pastoral counselling, control and discipline within a church context. Some of the kinds of things that have been seen as being more broadly spiritually abusive, these very controlling pastoral relationship, that's the kind of context in which these kinds of conversations could fall to be criminal. Or the other action is probably areas in which people engage in attempting to exorcise demons of homosexuality, which most Christians would think is not a right practice anyway. But I think that is probably the kind of area that might not be currently covered by legislation, but would probably fall within the ambit of what's being said here. But the vast majority of what ordinary evangelical churches do in the way of preaching and teaching and advice and help, particularly to same-sex attracted people, encouraging them not to change their sexual orientation, but to resist desires and not to act on them because they want to follow Christ faithfully, is highly unlikely to lead to it being criminal, unless you're dealing with somebody who is very emotionally unstable and in danger of having their mental health severely harmed. So it would require great care in thinking about the person that we are speaking to and how we're speaking to them.
Mm. Can I ask, go on.
Go on, you can ask me a question.
I was going to ask you a question.
Something I wanted to say, but you say it first.
Well, I was going to ask you, Adrian, because you mentioned this earlier when we were planning this. As a church leader, how do you deal with the fact that this kind of thing keeps coming round again and again?
You. That was what I was going to raise.
Yeah, that's funny because we planned it like that. But that is an important question, isn't it? Because we seem to be wanting to legislate more and more against Christian practice. Mm. Yeah. And that seems to be the culture we're living in. It raises fears for leaders.
It is a good question. And in a broader context, people often write to us and say, why don't you cover this story? Or you should have covered that story. And we just don't. I mean, we're doing three stories today, and there have been 300 stories in the news. So why do you choose certain stories? We're always trying to think about, what's the leadership lesson? So, for example, we didn't really talk about the reintroduction of the assisted dying bill, or assisted suicide bill, we would perhaps call it. We didn't really talk about that as being reintroduced because we thought we'd already sort of talked about that topic. But there does feel like a relentlessness about this. The stuff keeps coming around. It's not that long ago we were rejoicing that assisted dying bill had run out of time and had fallen. And then in the very next session of Parliament, in a private member's bill, it's reintroduced.
It's raised again.
Same form. So it does feel, as Christians engage with the world, I think, to some Christians, like we win an occasional battle, but we basically lose everything. And I think some Christians will feel this way about the Conversion Practices Bill. They'll just feel this is another thing. And then it'll be another thing. And then, someone will want to table an amendment to the Abortion Act. And it just feels like it's again and again and again. And everything seems to be a step away from what we would value as Christians and what we would love as Christians. And I think I want to be able to say to church members, and I think we as leaders need to be able to say that we shouldn't be surprised at that. But there is a sense in which the season we have enjoyed, where we have these Judeo-Christian values at the heart of everything, is not normal. It's not the normal Christian life in the New Testament. And we should be very thankful for it, and we should want to fight, and we should want to, not literally, but we should want to fight for this stuff and have a voice on this stuff and write to our MPs and have campaigning groups, all of the above. But behind all of that, we should realise that the normal Christian life actually is to not be normal, to be out of kilter with the world. We've just been looking at Acts in the at church and the Jerusalem Council. And it's interesting how basically the Jerusalem Council is about calling people out of pagan worship.
Yeah.
And that's the normal Christian environment, that people are against the gospel. And I think what we've got to give people is a sense in which, yes, there is a relentlessness about this, but don't be disheartened by that. Don't be discouraged by it. That is the normal way. And guess what? God is still in control. It's not that he's just a bit quiet at the moment. God is always on top. I'm speaking at Keswick in a few weeks' time about spiritual warfare. And I think a lot of people think the Christian life is a bit like a cage fight on the White House lawn. And it's God in one corner and the devil in the other. And sometimes God's got the upper hand and sometimes the devil's got the upper hand. But God always has the upper
hand.
It's
not like that.
He's always in control. And we've got to give people confidence in that. That even when it doesn't seem like it, we believe and we trust and we know. The Spirit gives us assurance that God is the God of all things and that one day all of that will be made right. So we're looking forward to that day. That's why the closing prayer of the Bible is, come, Lord Jesus. But in the meantime, we have confidence and we're not surprised at all these slings and arrows.
I mean, it's difficult to know how to respond to this, and no doubt this will not necessarily become legislation in this form. It will obviously be interrogated by Parliament. There'll be a lot of opposition. I think I oppose it because I think it's uncertain. It will create uncertainty. It will create concern. It's worth saying that quite a lot of it is designed at sort of dealing with the idea that people might be sent overseas to have this kind of therapy, so that there are other countries and other cultures where very different attitudes towards homosexuality are taken. So there's a desire to want to prevent people being sent overseas to be treated in these ways. There's liability for individuals who allow others to undertake these conversion practices. There's a very specific liability for church leaders as office holders in their sort of association who would be liable if they allow the church to undertake this. So actually, as leaders, you might be, as elders, you might be responsible for what pastorally is done in the church. So those are issues there. But I think we also need to recognize that it isn't as draconian as we might imagine. And it's not the same as the position in Victoria, which basically limits what Christians can do in the way of what we might regard as ordinary ministry. And I think the question for us to think through as we engage with this is, what practices do we want to think should be legitimate, which actually cause serious physical or mental harm to somebody, or which cause serious alarm and distress that prevents them living their ordinary everyday life? So it's quite a difficult thing to advocate. We want to be able to perform those practices. As Christians, I would say in our ordinary ministry, we ought to be cautious of anything that is causing that level of harm to individuals. There must be something about whether or not we're doing something appropriate if it's causing that level of harm to somebody. And at one level, it seems that we ought to recognise that our pastoral ministry should not be doing that. The legislation is not saying we've broken the law just because somebody's offended by what we say or by their distress. It's the degree of harm that is caused to them. So I think the major problem with this legislation is the absolute uncertainty of definition, which is going to cause all sorts of concerns for people.
Well, it's worth saying that the campaigning Christian groups are going to be opposing this. Of course, you should feel free to write your MP. They will have model letters that you can use, I'm sure, and that kind of thing.
The other thing I object to in this is actually healthcare is excluded altogether, which at one level says something about the idolatry of our culture, that healthcare, if these practices are done in the context which is deemed healthcare, then actually they're not regarded as being conversion practices, which I think is a reflection of the way that in our society, medical health care is valued, but spiritual soul care is not. And that's not unlike the same sorts of differences that were being drawn in COVID times over what is essential and what's not. And in our secular culture, the, for want of a better word, spiritual care that we provide is not regarded as being significant and important.
That sounds like a whole nother podcast. Time is going. Let's move on to another story. We normally end with a sports story, but we're going to put a sports story in the middle of this kind of news sandwich. And this is about cricketer Ben Stokes. Now, John is a huge fan of the England cricket team, but this is Ben Stokes, who announced his retirement from England's cricket team and as captain of the England team during the test against New Zealand. He then took a wicket with the next ball after he'd announced his retirement. But then extraordinarily, to me at least, put himself in as the opening batsman for the next innings, was out relatively quickly, and England lost the test. And it just felt like a very poor way to leave your role. Have I read too much into that? That's no, how I
think
interpreted
you're being too
it.
Generous.
Okay.
I don't think it's just a very poor way. I think he was petulant. I think he was acting like a spoiled child, frankly.
But he's a great cricketer.
He is
a great
cricketer,
can't we?
And I think I've read comments online with people saying, you know, he's a great cricketer, and that you just get this with great cricketers. It goes with the territory. If you want the great cricketer, you have to have all the kind of
foibles,
character flaws as well. I just don't buy that. I think, and certainly as a model of Christian leadership, it definitely doesn't work. You know, we're not looking for mavericks who break all the rules in order to get the job done. Actually, there are some very definite qualities that are required for leadership. And I would argue, actually, even in the sporting arena, there are some very definite qualities required for leadership. And I think, actually, although he is clearly a great cricketer and has played some great innings, taken some great wickets, this last little bit of throwing the toys out of the pram proves that he's unfit to be the leader, in my opinion. There we go. Just a sort of, you know, forthright opinion.
Yeah. Just don't sit on the fence on it, Adrian. Tell us what you really think. John, England went on to lose the test. And there's a lesson there, isn't there? So he wasn't playing for the team in that moment.
I think that's right. I want to channel my inner Geoffrey Boycott and Fred Truman here and say it's just not test cricket. And I think, actually, I've been frustrated with the whole way that England has played. I mean, test cricket it's a five-day sort of... sport. It needs to be played with patience and care, and Stokes is no doubt a superbly talented player. He can smack the ball around, he's a flash player, he's got astonishing gifting, and actually that is now shaped by one day internationals, 2020. It's a different kind of game, but actually
nightclub brawls.
Test cricket requires kind of the patience of being able to build big innings. You can't just smack the ball around. A decent bowler will find flaws in that, and that's exactly what happened. I think sort of baz ball as a way of playing has simply not delivered results in the long
term. Baz ball, if you don't know, is the kind of, you know, really go for it all the time approach.
On the front foot cricket.
So I think the way that his decision to put himself into bat at the beginning, smack the ball around, get 30 and get out, actually, it was shown later, it was a winnable test. We could have won the series against New Zealand if we'd had
our proper openers,
kind of a patient, wear the bowlers down, kind of enable later batsmen to come in and be able to hit it around with a greater freedom. And one thinks about kind of Mike Atherton and some of his incredibly long opening innings that did that. And by putting himself in and playing flash, effectively set an example that condemned England to lose. So I think it felt like a very self-centered decision, both to open and to play in that manner, which is a bit characteristic of what's been this era of test cricket. And the results speak for themselves. So he's been very, very entertaining to watch, been great in the one-day internationals and winning the World Cup. But actually, for the test of test match cricket that requires endurance, perseverance, patience, the willingness to go slowly, it's a totally different discipline. And I think actually that's interesting in church leadership, because I think we often want the flash leader who accomplishes a lot quickly. We are attracted to the Ben Stokes type player who will kind of take it to
the opposition.
We find that all the more entertaining to watch. We feel good about it. But actually ministry itself is a long slog of constant slow progress. It's much more like playing test cricket over the long run. And actually that just requires that disciplined perseverance and care, a different kind of leadership. I think might be great for playing T20 and one day international, but not for the context of test match cricket. So I felt it ended badly.
There's something here about leaving well, isn't there, for Christian leaders to think about. How do we leave a position in church
clearly
well.
There had been a breakdown of trust. Yeah. We've talked about that before. Yeah. So I think there was an inevitability at some stage he was going to go reasonably soon, whether it was now or after the next series. So I think it was inevitable he was going to go. And basically, he's wanted to leave on his own terms, and he's left carnage behind him. And I think... even when you feel you've been unfairly treated, as I think he does, I mean, he's been a little bit coy about what he said, but I think the whole being banned for one match, I think he feels he's been unjustly treated. Even if you feel that, if you really love the sport, in this case, if you love the church, if you really love the people you're playing with and the fans, in this case,
the congregation, church,
the congregation, you will forego your own right. To justice to a certain level. Now, don't get me wrong, there are certain circumstances where it's right to pursue justice, and I think that's right and proper. But actually, sometimes, even when you've been treated unjustly, the wise thing to do is to go quietly. I think Romans 12 speaks about that. That, you know, as far as possible, live at peace with everyone. But then as you read on through Romans 12, you realise there is a situation where it's just right to leave things with the Lord. Let him deal with this, and don't you deal with it. And some people will always mishear that as saying you don't care about justice, you should be pursuing justice. Well, I think you should pursue justice, but not at all costs. And actually, where it starts harming others, and especially leaving behind a trail of destruction in a church, I think you've got to think very carefully about that.
And Romans 12 is followed by Romans 13, which is always where you can do some of that.
Another slightly different angle on this, obviously we don't know the individual and the full circumstances, is I think it was Michael Vaughan who made the point that if you lose the passion for the game, you don't want to be playing anymore, you just can't do it anymore. And there is some sort of suggestion that basically he has lost the passion for being England captain. There's no doubt there's significant sacrifices that are made, all the hard work, all the training, travelling, being on tour. I heard Ben Stokes talk about he wanted to have more time with his family, with his kids, to be able to do things with them. That there's a sense in which actually that cost is no longer sustainable. Mm-hmm. So it may be that he just reached a point at which actually he could no longer carry on living and working in that way. And I think if you have lost the passion for it, which means that the cost of it is too great, then of course it's right to step away, and you'd want to do that graciously. I think that can be true in ministry. The people who start out with great passion for ministry, they don't perhaps appreciate what the costs might be, the amount of time that has to be given to it, the cost in family and what you can't do. And I think if you've lost that and end up just doing it out of going through the motions, that's actually not a good situation for anybody. Now, somebody who's reached that point, they may want to take some time out. They may want to take a sabbatical, take a break. Pastors are often very bad at taking that break. Churches are very bad at giving them the time to be able to take that break. And they might recover something of the joy and the passion kind of for that. But if that has gone, then actually probably it's right to leave and do something different. Because actually it will not be good for you, your family, or the church. And recognizing that honestly, and then leaving graciously is a right and proper thing to do.
Well, the England captaincy is vacant.
Yeah, there we are, John. It could be something you could throw your cap into the ring for. We've got 5 minutes-ish to talk about our final story.
Can we?
This is about what do you wear to lead at church?
Yes, or so, indeed, play at Wimbledon.
Well, we can get to that, can't we? So this is an article that Angela Tilby wrote for the Church Times, arguing for the cassock to show that you are the church leader at the front, obviously, in Anglican circles. It's quite an interesting conversation, though, because it does matter what we wear. And I know, I've said on the podcast before, my brother's an Anglican. He would argue that there are free church robes, by which he means the way that we dress.
There's a US book that's just come out, which suggests that if you don't own a pair of Oxford brogues, you should be jolly well be going out and buying them.
But it's an interesting conversation, isn't it? Because the way we dress does matter. It does communicate something. And we thought this was an interesting thing to reflect on.
It is. And I think the Naomi Osaka little piece of it, just to add to the flavour of it, and Andy Burnham comes into this as well. But this is like multiple stories all in one.
In the way people
because
dress.
Because Andy Burnham, who used to always be dressed in a suit, now he's dressed in his Northern T-shirt and bucket hat, I think, from Manchester. So he's now definitely got a look that he's cultivating. I think that's fairly clear. So even at his press conference yesterday, he was dressed in his bomber jacket, and his bomber jacket has made it into a museum of Manchester. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Naomi Osaka has gone from just arriving on court in the tracksuit, as most players do, to having bespoke outfits created. I love it. I think
all in white. So
well,
keep
Wimbledon,
with the Wimbledon,
all in white. Yeah. So she's worn this extraordinary. You just need to Google it and have a look. It's an extraordinary outfit. It's worth saying she doesn't play in it.
No.
So it is a statement for entering court. So I think there is a difference there. She's not kind of saying, you know, she's not trying to present something on court. She's realizing that when you get on court, she's got to wear regular stuff that works and enables her to be a good athlete. But she's trying to just sort of elevate, you know, the sort of coming onto court to a slightly different level, which I don't mind that so much. But I think the question about what you wear in church is interesting. Now, so for example, I mean, you can judge me on this if you like, Phil, I don't mind. I won't wear shorts to lead a church or to preach. Now, you know me, I'm not today, but I often wear shorts in the summer.
It's been noted.
But I don't wear shorts to lead or preach because just I feel in our church, in our context, some of the people we have, it's not that I don't think people would think ill of me, but I don't particularly want to be a stumbling block to people. I want to be sort of semi-smart, I suppose. And that's not because I think I'm different from other people. I just want to be able to lead everybody. And I think if I turned up in shorts and a t-shirt, I'm not sure that would be helpful for people. So I am trying to think in terms of what I wear, what will be helpful to people. I'm not trying to think I'm setting myself up to be different. That's the key thing. So I think the article in the Times was sort of saying, you know, actually, when you wear these things, you're presenting yourself as different, as in a different category from everyone else. And, you know, if you lived in Bermuda, where literally everyone wears shorts, even the police have shorts, I think you'd be foolish to wear long trousers.
Yeah.
So I think it is contextual. But what we're trying to do, I think, as leaders is we are trying to lead, but we're also trying to lead as a member of the congregation ourselves. So I think actually what you wear does matter. The answer is just not what Angela Tilbury thinks it is.
John?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it seems to me that clothing does convey things about you. Clothing always is a manifestation of things, and clothing is a way of expressing sex. It's a way of expressing status, class, education, wealth. It's a way of expressing or projecting power. It's a way of indicating whether you want to be treated as being cool and attractive in that sort of sense. So the Bible is fully aware that clothing has significance. So the New Testament talks about kind of being modest in dress. It talks about not having hairstyles that basically convey the sense of being rich and wealthy that then assert power in a context or that alienate people who are poorer in a way. So I think we do need to be sensitive to the fact that how we choose to dress is a way in which we are often saying something about ourselves. And we need to be kind of mindful of that. So being thoughtful about what we wear and what it conveys, I think is very significant. So you can go into some very conservative churches in which people wear quite conservative clothing, but actually it's an exercise in the projection of power. It's a form of power dressing in that particular context. And you can find that in churches that are very casual as well. And as Adrian was saying, I think it's about context. It seems to me that when we're leading, what we want to do is we want to reflect something of a reverence and a respect that we're conveying, that we're not treating this casually, we're not treating God casually. And we want to convey something of we are in line with the normal, ordinary dress of the people we happen to be kind of leading. So I think trying to pitch it in a way in which it is contextually appropriate in that it is the dress of ordinary people. Actually, interestingly, clerical clothing, certainly in nonconformity and the Puritan period, was actually a version of the ordinary normal dress of the day. It just then became adopted in subsequent, it became religious dress that was then used when that fashion was no longer along those lines. But it was actually a desire to want to be respectable, but not different. Yeah. And I think that's really where we want to pitch it. And we need to be mindful of how the way we dress is, what does that convey to everybody else? Are you welcome here or are you kind of not? So I think very often in any particular contextual situation, the dress that will be appropriate for those leading is essentially going to be middle of the road, because that's going to be able to bring together a breadth of people who don't feel intimidated or excluded by that particular look. And I think that just is the way to reach the largest group of people and to hold them together.
Maybe, Phil, you could make the shirt that you're wearing today available as an FIUC clothing item.
Well, I did. My loudest shirt.
It is loud.
I'm sorry about that. I didn't really think about that when I put it on this morning, but there we are. So people who are watching will have had the delight of seeing that. John, you look like you want to make a final serious point.
I just try to wear what I would normally wear in a kind of a more formal context. And of course, actually, you can vary. If you're going to a funeral, if you're going to a wedding, then the dress is appropriate. If you're going to a church that has a particular different style, you don't make a point of dressing differently. I can remember once when I was in an Anglican church, an Australian preacher came who basically insisted on wearing a holy sweater because he didn't want to wear clerical robes. And he was making a deliberate point. And I thought that's just not appropriate. If you're going into a context in which there's an established norm, you basically fit with that norm. So I quite often travel when I'm traveling in church. My basic smart casual, but I've normally got a jacket with me with a tie in the pocket that just opens up every possibility. Because when I arrive, if I don't know, I want to think what's going to be appropriate for this people that's going to most enable them to be able to hear the word when I preach it, that's not going to alienate anybody and that's not going to draw attention. So I kind of go multi-prepared. And then often try to judge it on the basis of
the John Stevens traveling wardrobe.
In the AI world, Phil, someone will send us a meme of the John Stevens traveling wardrobe doll with all the different outfits.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to the traveling wardrobe, which is available to purchase.
I don't think I've ever preached in shorts.
Fine. Brothers, time has gone. Enjoy your holidays when they come. Thank you for joining us on Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate and leave a review so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon. God bless.
Thanks, Phil.